Hale. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And right now, of course, I'm asking you to hold your calls. Your telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY at 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being. We'll open up at the very end of the program. Mr. Dreyfus, who's our special guest this evening, can only be with us for about 40 minutes, but Mr. Robert Dreyfus has written a fascinating book called The Devil's Game. Now, have you ever wondered where this whole radical Islamic movement came from? I mean, did it just sort of come out of nowhere? Did it really begin when Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen were fighting in Afghanistan in the 1980s? Or where did it really begin? Well, Mr. Dreyfus has traced the history of this movement back to the 1860s, 1880s, to another time and another era. And I think you'll be surprised at how this whole thing came about. Mr. Dreyfus, thank you so very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's really my pleasure.
And now, remember, this is a different audience, so you can repeat everything you've said before, and I think they'll be fascinated. First of all, how is it that you happened to write this book? Because it's a very important book. We needed to get into the background of what's the origin of this radical form of Islam that is really a threat to the survival of Christian civilization today.
Well, you know, like any religion, Islam has had conservative and moderate and liberal and free-thinking versions going back centuries. But really, I would say in the 20th century, there started to emerge an organized force of what I would call the Islamic Right. These were groups that were ultra-conservative, but also organized in a political way. And you can date it, I guess, for the sake of argument, with the founding of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt in the 1920s. And by the time of the Cold War, the Muslim Brotherhood had grown into a fairly significant organization in Egypt and other countries from Syria and Jordan and Pakistan and elsewhere. And during those years, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the Muslim Brotherhood often worked with some of the most reactionary elements in the region, got funding from Saudi Arabia's ultra-conservative Wahhabi clergy. They developed relationships with the various kings, like the king of Egypt, Farouk, and also with the British. The British saw these Islamic groups as potentially useful allies in battling some of the anti-colonial movements and the anti-imperialist forces that were trying to get the British out of Suez or out of India and so forth.
And, of course, they really were not interested in Arab nationalism. They really wanted sort of an Arab internationalism, but they were quite willing to make common cause with the British. And wasn't British intelligence and then sometime later the CIA involved with helping these organizations, this radical Islamic movement?
That's right. When the Cold War started, after World War II, and the United States started to replace the British as the main power in the region, the United States started to see these Islamic groups as allies.
And, of course, I think this is the part of the story that nobody likes to talk about today, that at least as you read the book, you find out that many times it was American money that was helping to actually foment this whole radical Islamic movement. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and perhaps could we, before we get too far into what's going on today, how about let's go back to the very beginning. You describe a gentleman named Afghani. Afghani wasn't an Afghani at all. Apparently he was a Persian, but this was, what, the 1860, 1880 period? Would you like to go into the background there of where this really began? Of course, we always had the Wahhabis, but then there was this other gentleman who played such an important part as the forerunner of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yes, Afghani is a very important and fascinating figure. He died in the, the 1890s after a 30-year career as almost a whirling dervish organizer. He traveled from Persia to Afghanistan, to India, to Egypt, to Turkey. He spent years in Europe, and he founded, along the way, a whole series of pan-Islamic secret societies.
No, pan-Islamic secret societies. So there really were secret societies involved in this then?
Yes, they were, sort of underground movements of people who did not admit, publicly that they belonged to these movements, but they had a kind of a secret knowledge. And this was not... This was, common at the time. There were Freemason movements and others that existed at this point, some of them quite innocuous, others perhaps more political. And Afghani interacted with them as well, various Freemason lodges in places like Cairo and in Turkey. But he was really the architect, the first one who came up with this idea of a political movement to unite Islam. But it wasn't as, pristine or honest as you might think, because he tried to sell this idea with varying degrees of success to the British and the Russians and others who were engaged in a fairly high-stakes, what they called the Great Game at the time, struggling over the Middle East and Central Asia, competing, that is, the British versus the Russians, in competing for influence in that part of the world. And Afghani proposed, especially to the British, who apparently helped him during important parts of his career, to try to unite the Muslims in alliance with Britain in kind of a pan-Islamic bloc that would be pro-British, and would support London's efforts against Russia.
Hold that thought right there for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Robert Dreyfuss, and we're talking about his book, Devil's Game, which we think is a very important book, and it goes into the background of a man. We've been talking about him. His name was Afghani. He was really a Persian, but he was trying to pose as an Arab, and he was really pushing this idea of pan-Islam, or uniting the whole world, and something called a caliphate, something that would really unite the Muslim world against the rest of the world. But he was using British intelligence. He himself was a Freemason, but he had contacts with British intelligence, and then, of course, apparently he was, had contacts with the Russians. He was willing to go any place that he could get support. But actually, didn't he end up as the prime minister of one of the countries over there for a time?
He became prime minister of Iran for a while, and he was eventually kicked out of Iran, and one of his followers ended up assassinating the Shah, who was a longtime king of Persia until the 1890s, and then he ended up dying a few years later. But he left a legacy. He was sort of the ideological grandfather of this pan-Islamic movement. Now, I should say, by the way, there's nothing wrong with uniting Islam, just the way there's nothing wrong with uniting the 50 states of the United States into a republic. But this was an explicitly political plus religious effort that had a very, I think, perverted notion of what Islam really means. It's an originalist kind of 7th century version of an Islamic empire that imposed an outlook which was very anti-modern, which certainly would not fit with modern learning and science and political freedoms. So here was a case where it was an explicit attempt to bring that part of the world really backwards, away from the modernizing outlook of the 19th and 20th centuries. And his followers were primarily based in Egypt. He spent years there himself, and he had a follower, a man named Abdu, Muhammad Abdu, who again became very close to the British colonial powers in Cairo. Abdu, in turn, was the godfather politically of a man named Hassan al-Banna, who founded the Muslim Brotherhood in 1928. And it's widely recognized by scholars of Islam, political Islam, that Afghani, Abdu, and Banna, those three, are kind of like grandfather, father, and son in the movement that created the modern version of political Islam. And of course, what gave it a big boost was after the Saudi Arabian Kingdom was established, also in the 1920s, and also, by the way, by the British, the Saudis became the financial backers of the Muslim Brotherhood for the next, 75 years, I would say, until 9/11. And so Saudi Arabia, which was based on this very ultra-Orthodox Wahhabi version of Islam, found that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt was the best expression of that outside of Saudi Arabia. And so the Saudis and the Muslim Brotherhood became kind of an alliance which has lasted for many decades. And it was this alliance that the United States encountered when it was looking for allies in the region in the 1950s that were both anti-communist and opposed to some of the upstart nationalists like Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt. And so for these two reasons, because the Muslim Brotherhood and the Saudi Wahhabis were strongly anti-communist, and because they were strongly anti-nationalist, they got American backing, and we played various political games with them over the years. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the Afghan Jihad, which was the most pure expression of that alliance. But, you know, in my book, I go into many other examples and background on how this theory developed of Islam as a barrier to communism. And of course, the problem with all this, you can say, well, anything goes during the Cold War. I happen to think that playing with religion is extremely dangerous. It's not the same thing as paying off some colonel or buying, you know, funding some political party or something, because religion is a very uncontrollable force. And, of course, then we found out after the Cold War that these religious fundamentalists had their own agenda. They weren't just anti-communist, but once the Soviet Union was gone, they turned and expressed the anti-Western component of their political and religious philosophy.
Well, before we get into that, and I think that's a very important issue, but I just want to get back to Afghani, and I thought one of the most significant things I learned from reading your book is that Afghani, the father or the grandfather, as it were, of the Muslim Brotherhood, because it was two generations after Afghani was presiding and there in the Middle East, and that we had the Muslim Brotherhood created in 1928, but Afghani kept talking about Allah and about the Islamic faith and professes this deep belief, and yet you pointed out that he really didn't believe in Allah, he didn't believe in God. It was really all about a political struggle, about a power structure. That was really a very interesting point.
Yeah, he believed apparently in the what analysts have called the political utility of religion. In other words, He believed in the secret truth and then a public truth.
In other words, he was talking about the dedicated belief to Allah and the dedication to this going back to it was the time of the prophet, but he really didn't believe it at all. It was simply used as a vehicle to get ahead?
Yes, well, I don't know about to get ahead. That's true in terms of his personal ambition, but I think he viewed it more in the sense that the masses are too uneducated for me to explain to them the way that I'm thinking politically. So I have to create this myth for them to bring them together around this notion that they can grasp that the Quran is the political constitution and not just a moral or religious document. And so by proposing that publicly, he was preaching to the masses, while within his own circles, we know from reading his letters and other things after his death, he really had no use for religion. He was what was called then a free thinker. Whether he was an atheist or not, I don't know. Perhaps that's the best way to describe it. But he was somebody who saw religion as a tool rather than as a fundamental true belief system.
And I think that was really so important that he really was using religion and this whole idea to pursue an agenda that he had. And you know, as I read your story, it, obviously there was a powerful force around this. I mean, anybody can get up and talk about religion, but you don't get to be the prime minister of a country. You don't get to travel all over. You don't get the following he had unless there was some sort of a force behind him. Did you ever have that feeling as you analyzed this? Was this his brilliance? Or was this his charisma? Or was there some sort of a force that was pushing him?
No, he clearly latched on to the imperial powers. His main voyage, which brought him to public prominence, is when he traveled from India to Egypt aboard a British vessel where he was, you know, shown great deference and was clearly brought over to Egypt by British intelligence because they believed that he was a charismatic figure and someone who was willing to work with the British colonial office to advance British interests in that whole area between India and the Mediterranean that they consider the heart of their empire.
And so really the British were using Afghani was using the British. Was that the force then that you think was propelling him?
Well, for most of his career, I would say that's true. And certainly when he was in India, certainly when he was in Egypt, for a time he lived in Paris and he published a journal there called The Indissoluble Bond, and that became one of the landmark newspapers or magazines of the pan-Islamic movement. And apparently at that point he was getting some support from the French secret services. He also went to Russia and tried to get the Tsar's support. Apparently he had somewhat fickle loyalties. But I would think, aside from his voyages to France and Russia, I think primarily he was allied with the British during most of his career.
All right, fine. There are listeners out there. This is a gentleman named Afghani. And, of course, Afghani then was the grandfather of the Muslim Brotherhood, because it was two generations later than in 1928 when the Muslim Brotherhood is created in Egypt, and this becomes the father of what we really see as Al-Qaeda today. And, of course, Muslim Brotherhood was aligned with Saudi Arabia. And then after the Second World War, the United States was backing both the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia and the Muslim Brotherhood, because they were opposing Arab nationalists, and of course, yes, many times the Arab nationalists were not anti-communists, and this is one reason why we dislike Nasser so much, and of course why we oppose Nasser, because I don't think he was a communist, but he certainly was not pro-Western. And anyway, we'll be back in this in just a moment or two, because this is an important part of the history. If you don't understand the past, you can't understand the present. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and for our listeners, it was Nasser came to power in 1952 or 1953, and then ruled up through 1970. He played an important part in the crisis that occurred in the late 1956, when, of course, they had the revolt in Hungary, and at the same time they had the attempt of the British and the French to seize the Suez Canal. But you tell the story. You know it far better than I do. Where does Nasser fit into this whole thing? Where does the Muslim Brotherhood fit in as far as Nasser is concerned?
Well, at first, I think the United States and the CIA under President Truman looked somewhat favorably on Nasser, because they thought that the king of Egypt was a decrepit old man and someone who couldn't hold the country together. But Nasser came to power at a time when all over the so-called Third World there were stirrings of anti-colonial leaders and independence-minded leaders and so forth. Certainly Nasser was not a communist. He appealed to the United States first for military aid and arms, and he appealed to the United States for economic aid to build the Aswan Dam. But by the time the Eisenhower administration had come in, we had leaders in Washington who didn't like independent-minded leaders like Nasser, because even if they weren't communists, they weren't willing to join alliances, and that was the word of the day. We were creating military alliances, and so was the Soviet Union, which had the Warsaw Pact, where we set up NATO. We were creating CETO and CENTO and the Baghdad Pact, and Nasser didn't want any of that. He certainly wasn't joining those Soviet alliances, but he was appealing to the United States, support me as an independent leader, and there were people in the CIA who agreed with that, who said, yeah, Nasser is the future of the Arab world. He's modern, he's charismatic, he has a lot of influence. But in the end, the British view and the French view prevailed. And we supported the colonial powers. We tried to replace them in places where they were withdrawing because their empires were shrinking. And so Nasser became viewed as someone who was untrustworthy, dangerous, and unreliable. And of course, Nasser, after getting turned down by the United States when he tried to buy arms in the West, turned to Czechoslovakia, which was part of the Soviet bloc. And that confirmed the worst suspicions of the British and the Americans, who said, aha, you see, he's a communist after all. And so from that point on, there was a continual effort to undermine or destabilize Nasser, to weaken him. And because of the power of Islam, the Muslim Brotherhood was by far the strongest opposition force inside Egypt. And so the United States, and especially the British, which were still then strong in that part of the world, started playing around not only with the Muslim Brotherhood, but with Saudi Arabia, which supported these Islamist forces in Egypt.
And so basically what we were doing was trying to destabilize Nasser's government. We wouldn't like anybody coming in here and trying to destabilize our government, but we went into Egypt and we tried to destabilize the man who was running that and really wasn't doing too bad a job, trying to improve the lot of the tragic people there within Egypt. And of course this takes, well, we'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Robert Dreyfus, and we're talking about his book, The Devil's Game. That's Robert Dreyfus. The book is The Devil's Game. And, you know, I think it's very, very important that The people, there's one wonderful quotation in the book, but from Nasser, and he's writing to President Kennedy. He's saying, "You Americans never make stupid mistakes. You make complicated, stupid mistakes, so we can't figure out that maybe we've missed something about what you're doing."
Yeah, the turning point in the relationship with Nasser and the Muslim Brotherhood was in 1954. The Muslim Brotherhood tried to assassinate Nasser. And he struck back at the organization with, full force of his police and his security services and forced many of their leaders into exile. But at that point, the United States still had the choice of supporting or opposing Nasser. And the quote that you referred to really refers to Nasser's surprise when we suddenly, in the United States, opted to support King Faisal in Saudi Arabia, who was busily trying to create an Islamic bloc. And we had the Eisenhower Doctrine, which closely bound us to Saudi Arabia, which was seen by almost every Arab as a reprehensible, greedy, and dissolute monarchy. And yet, that became our principal Arab ally. So we aligned ourselves with the worst, most despised forces in the Arab world and ended up opposing Nasser, who fought a series of overt and covert wars against Saudi Arabia, most notably in Yemen. There was a war that raged throughout the 1960s in Yemen between Egypt and Saudi Arabia. And throughout this, the Muslim Brotherhood was the principal opposition force inside Egypt. So the idea, and we now know that Saeed Ramadan, for instance, who was one of the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood, had officially signed on, according to German archives that have been uncovered, and other work that's been done by me and a reporter in Switzerland and others. We know that Ramadan was an official agent of the CIA, and I found a photograph of him in the Oval Office with President Eisenhower.
Now, Ramadan was basically the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Well, he was their chief international organizer.
Okay.
He'd been expelled from Egypt by Nasser, so he settled in Switzerland, and he set up a Islamic center in Geneva, which became kind of the nerve center for the worldwide Muslim Brotherhood. I don't think he ever achieved the title of, leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. That was reserved for someone who stayed in Egypt.
Oh, no, but of course,
he was their main organizer.
How did he finance this? Was he financed, do you think, by the intelligence agencies when he was in Switzerland? Because you just don't go to live in Switzerland, and put out a magazine. You got to have money.
Well, it was more than a magazine. He had a whole institution there, a major Islamic center, but it was heavily funded by Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
The Saudis and the king of Saudi Arabia personally put a great deal of money into Ramadan's work.
Now, of course, are we backing Saudi Arabia? Are we doing everything we can to keep them in power?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, of course, we were most of all interested in the oil and not the royal family.
Well, of course, the royal family was the key to the oil. We had contracts. American companies had contracts with the royal family, so we were going to see they stayed in power, even though they were ruthless. I mean, they mistreated women. They cut off people's hands and heads and all sorts of, just like the Taliban was doing, really.
Well, not only that, but massively corrupt and so forth. And it wasn't just that we had contracts at the time until the mid-1970s. Saudi Arabia's oil was actually owned by the four big American oil companies. The company Aramco was completely owned and operated by Exxon, Mobil, Chevron, and Texaco. And the Saudis didn't even have any say in it. This was at a time when the oil companies ruled international oil, and none of these Arab countries or OPEC didn't even exist until much later. I mean, this is at a time when the oil companies really ran the international oil business and were the real kings of Saudi Arabia.
And, of course, basically, that we were backing the people. The Saudi government was backing the Muslim Brotherhood. And of course, the Saudi government was backing the Wahhabis. And the Wahhabis and the Muslim Brotherhood are really the foundation of what we call Al-Qaeda today, aren't they?
Yes, it's several generations from the time we're talking about until Al-Qaeda was formed. But ideologically, the Muslim Brotherhood grew ever more radical as time went on.
All right.
Refined its ideology.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Robert Dreyfus. His book is Devil's Game. And basically, could you explain to our listeners why you call it Devil's Game? You know, because what you're really inferring is that we sort of created the devil, or at least we work with the devil.
Well, I see the words Devil's Game as really referring to a game that you can't win because the other side is devilish or has stacked the deck against you. I think when you play with religion, you're playing with a force that is far more volatile and dangerous, kind of like nitroglycerin, than just normal political games. And so I think ultimately it was a devil's game because we were destined to be outflanked and outfoxed and to lose. And I think that's what ultimately happened when the movement of political Islam grew faster and extended broader than we ever believed it could, and in many respects, got out of control, sometimes without us realizing what was in fact happening.
Well, now, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood still seemed to be more or less centered in Egypt, and, of course, as time went by, of course, we're in the 1980s, then, of course, we have the Muslim Brotherhood actually killing Anwar Sadat, really in reprisal for the fact that he had signed a peace agreement with Israel. And, of course, then we get the Mubarak, who's there today. But certainly the Muslim Brotherhood then has always been in resistance against the government there in Egypt. But we were backing the government on one hand. We were backing the Muslim Brotherhood with the other. Didn't we continue with one hand backing the Muslim Brotherhood at the same time we were supposedly buddy-buddy with Anwar Sadat and then Mubarak?
Well, even Sadat himself. What happened was after Nasser died in 1970, who had strongly repressed the Muslim Brotherhood, Sadat became president. And he brought the Muslim Brotherhood back into Egypt, in part to help him create a political base for himself, because he came into power with very little political support. And he, Sadat himself, used the Muslim Brotherhood against the pro-Nasser forces in Egypt. And that's one of the great ironies of history, because he actually brought back into Egypt, led, by the way, by Saeed Ramadan, who we talked about earlier, and financed by Saudi Arabia. He brought the Muslim Brotherhood back into Egypt.
Hold that thought there for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Robert Dreyfus. His book is Devil's Game, and we recommend the book. And if you'd like to know more about it, you can give us a call at 1-800-454-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And you really need to get the interviews we've done with Mr. Dreyfus. Give you tremendous insight into the background. But Mr. Dreyfus was talking about how Anwar Sadat, after Nasser died in 1970, then, of course, Sadat comes to power. And what does he do? He brings back the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood. Now, I think he had actually been a member of that, hadn't he, or been affiliated with it?
Yes, in the 1940s, Anwar Sadat was a member of the Brotherhood, and for a time, until it was banned, he was Nasser's liaison to the Muslim Brotherhood.
So he comes into power, Sadat comes into power, he wants to use the Muslim Brotherhood as his political base, and so he brings them back in. They've been outlawed, they've been driven out of Egypt, he brings them back in, and then what happens?
Well, he allowed them and, in fact, encouraged them and even provided government funds for them to take over a number of institutions, and they began to take over the Lawyers Guild and the Engineers Guild and various medical societies. They began to establish themselves in universities. They started to create Islamic banks. It was like they began penetrating almost every part of Egyptian society. And people who went to Egypt at this time were stunned at how this country, which had been so secular in the 1960s, 10 years later, had become so religious, and men wearing beards and women wearing headscarves and covering up. And so this penetration of the Brotherhood went into every nook and cranny of Egyptian society. And
well, didn't they more or less force this upon the Egyptians? In other words, it wasn't necessarily they wanted to, but weren't they just sort of using almost intimidation to get everybody to go along with a more radical form of Islam?
Well, I don't know if that's true, Dr. Stan. I think that you'd find that there was a ready-made constituency for this outlook, in part because people were poor and angry and frustrated, and of course there'd been the catastrophic loss of the 1967 war with Israel, and a lot of people blamed Nasser for that defeat, and so the ideology of Arab nationalism had been greatly weakened, and people were looking for answers. And so then the Muslim Brotherhood comes and says, Islam is the solution. That was their slogan. And it was appealing to a minority, perhaps, of the population, but certainly a significant minority. And they gained strength, and Sadat encouraged them. And then they spawned ever more radical offshoots and branches. And it was one of those, namely Egyptian Islamic Jihad, that turned around and assassinated Sadat in 1981. So he only lasted 11 years as president. And I guess the most ironic thing about that is that when Sadat was assassinated, he was busy helping the CIA bring together worldwide Islamic radicals to fight in Afghanistan. He was shipping Egyptian radical Islamists to Afghanistan. He was training Afghans. He was, this was a blunder of colossal proportions for Sadat, because he was working with the very forces that ended up killing him.
But of course, we were doing the same thing. We, during the Afghan war, the CIA was recruiting these radical mujahideen, these holy warriors, from all over the world and bringing them to Afghanistan and indoctrinating them in this radical form of Islam. And, you know, we've even got some material. I don't know if you know John Cooley's book on holy wars. He talks about how the CIA was distributing Korans to these fighters, and you know, it was the battle against the infidels, kill the infidels. Weren't we actually promoting this radical form of Islam in Afghanistan during the 1980s?
Well, far worse than distributing Korans, which I wouldn't personally object to. We were teaching them how to make car bombs. We were teaching them how to do assassinations.
And we were actually training them, some of them, right here in the United States, and then sending them back again. I know I had Colonel Bo Greitz was teaching a lot of these Afghans right over here in the desert in Nevada. Of course, we're not supposed to be involved in other people's affairs, and we were determined we were going to wage a war over there. It was a CIA war.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And of course, it wasn't just Afghanistan. There were many people in the Carter administration and then in the Reagan administration who believed that Islam was a sword that could strike at the Soviet Union itself by rousing up the Muslims of Central Asia. And that became kind of a mini crusade for a while. The idea that the Soviet Muslims in what's now Uzbekistan and Tajikistan and the other Central Asian republics, Kazakhstan, well, all of those countries were then part of the Soviet Union. And so while this fighting was going on in Afghanistan, there was this notion that maybe it would inspire Muslims in the Soviet Union to rise up. So we were completely oblivious to the fact that we were creating a permanent radical religious army.
So like Dr. Frankenstein had no idea what he was creating.
That's right. And even there were even people who said after the Shah collapsed in Iran and Ayatollah Khomeini came into power, which was 1979, the same year that the Afghan War started, well, there were people who said, maybe this isn't so bad because maybe Khomeini will himself inspire Muslims in the Soviet Union. And I found a great quote from Zalmay Khalilzad, who's now our ambassador in Iraq, in which he wrote for the RAND Corporation about 1980, a paper saying that maybe Ayatollah Khomeini will be the undoing of the Soviet Union, and he is creating an Islamic movement that is already being felt in the Soviet Union and in Iraq. Now here's the man who's now the ambassador to Iraq dealing with that Islamic fundamentalist power that he was 25 years ago lauding and praising because it was going to weaken the Soviet Union and weaken Iraq, which was seen as a Soviet ally at the time.
Well, it's a fascinating, fascinating story, and I certainly commend you for writing it. I'm going to let you go because I know you have something else, but I just wanted you to briefly mention the relationship between the CIA and Israel and Hamas. Now, Hamas, everybody knows, is the enemy of Israel. Hamas is already radical. It's sort of an extension of the Muslim Brotherhood, this intense hatred of Israel. But didn't some of the Israelis play a hand in creating Hamas?
Oh, that's a fascinating story, and you're absolutely right. I mentioned earlier how Nasser had suppressed the Muslim Brotherhood. Well, at the time, what's now Gaza, the Gaza Strip, came under Egypt. And then in 1967, the Israelis occupied Gaza, took it over, along with the Sinai Peninsula, of course. And when they went into Gaza, where there were many thousands of Palestinian refugees, they freed all the members of the Muslim Brotherhood who'd been arrested by Egypt. And one of those was Ahmed Yassin, who was a radical preacher who founded Hamas in 1987, 1988. Well, this was back in 1967. And for the next 20 years, the Israelis encouraged Yassin. They helped the Islamists in the West Bank and in Gaza build a political force that they thought, the Israelis thought, would undermine the PLO and Yasser Arafat. Now, not all Israelis, by the way. I've been told, and I put in my book, that Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, thought this was completely dumb for the Israeli military occupation authorities to support the Islamists, because maybe they had Mossad had a better idea of what a danger this was. But still, the Israeli occupation authorities went ahead and allowed this movement to prosper. And it grew, and there were even clashes between Hamas, the early Hamas movement, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the PLO all over the West Bank at universities. So this movement grew and took root and finally established itself with Israeli support to the great then backfiring result that it turned into Israel's bitterest enemy. And as we know from today's news, the Palestinians are holding elections just about now in the West Bank and Gaza. And it looks like Hamas, if it doesn't win those elections, will do so well that it will cause an enormous problem for Israel, for the United States, and others, who then have to decide how do we deal with a new Palestinian government in the occupied territories that is heavily influenced by Hamas, which is considered a terrorist group, which is responsible for many of the suicide bombings and other carnage in Egypt, as distinct from the other Palestinians who sometimes engage in fighting Israel over the occupation, but try to veer away from suicide bombings aimed at civilians and restaurants and things like that. So you have now Hamas emerging as a major political force in the new Palestinian government. And so I guess the moral of this story is Israel made the same mistakes on a much smaller scale that the United States made on a much larger canvas. Their canvas was really just the tiny occupied territories around Israel, but we were supporting, that is, the United States, Islamist groups from Morocco to Indonesia into Central Asia, and so on a much bigger scale and much bigger scope.
Yeah, well, we could go on and on, but I know you have another obligation. I hope we can get you on to one of our other programs again, but thank you so very much for being with us. Our guest has been...
It's a pleasure to be on your show, and if you don't mind, I mentioned my website.
Well, go right ahead, please.
People can go and read not only about the book, but my articles and other things. It's just my name, Robert Dreyfus, like the actor, Robert Dreyfus.
That's with two S's?
Yes, D-R-E-Y. F-U-S-S, RobertDreyfus.com.
Right. RobertDreyfus.com, fascinating information. Thank you so very much for being with us. I know it's getting late where you are, and we'll look forward to talking to you some other time, but thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Good night. And, of course, we're going to have open lines. We've got about 15 minutes before our next exciting guest, but our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And I'd like to suggest that sometimes a lot of things don't make mistake, or we get this impression, oh, we just made another mistake. Oh, shucks, we just got such incompetent people. And I would like to suggest we do not have incompetent people. We have brilliant people who are orchestrating this whole situation. And if you follow the history of the Muslim Brotherhood, one of the men who planned the assassination of Anwar Sadat was the blind sheik Omar Rahman. And Rahman was then arrested by the Egyptians and thrown into prison. But if you read the book Unholy Wars by James Cooley, who was a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, he will tell you, as you know, that all the evidence suggests that the CIA got Rahman out of prison in Egypt. And then the next thing you know, why they're making arrangements for him to get a visa to come to the United States. So Omar Rahman is really a radical. He's a revolutionary. He's part of this whole radical Muslim Brotherhood. He wants violence. He's preaching violence and killing. So the CIA bring him to the United States, and he gets set up in a mosque, I believe it's in Brooklyn. And the next thing you know, why he's sending over to the Arab countries to get a bomber to blow up the World Trade Center. And of course, eventually he gets arrested and put into prison. But he sets up a whole terrorist system over here. Now, why would the CIA do something that stupid unintentionally? Why would they get this radical member of the Muslim Brotherhood out of prison in Egypt? Get him a visa to get in the United States. You're not supposed to bring terrorists in the United States. Those of you who have never seen the video, Jihad in America, you really need to get it. It was put together by Stephen Emerson. It was first shown in 1994 and then banned. Somebody put orders out it was not to be shown in America, and it was not available at all until after 9/11. Why? Because it's got all sorts of footage in there. It had to be shot by our intelligence agencies in 1988, and 1999, and 1990, and it shows them Arab radicals. Abdullah Azzam, who was the man who formed Al-Qaeda after the Afghan war, he's over in talking in Oklahoma City, talking about jihad and blood running in the streets and the violence they're going to perpetrate here in the United States. And then, of course, he gets killed late, I believe, in 88. And everybody thinks it's Osama bin Laden has done that. I suspect maybe he had a little help from the CIA, because now Osama bin Laden takes control of the world terrorist movement. And then the following year, you have pictures of other radical people from Al-Qaeda talking in Oklahoma City and other major cities. They've got pictures of the terrorist training camps, and the government knew all about it. Believe me, they knew who every radical was in this country that thoroughly infiltrated this whole movement. And this is the one thing that people don't understand. That our intelligence agencies, and there are 14 of them, they're not the CIA and FBI, and maybe the NSA, there are 14 intelligence agencies, they're very effective. We know that they say, oh, we couldn't infiltrate the Islamic terrorist movement, but then we find out that a couple of the terrorists were moving with an FBI informant in San Diego. And of course, they couldn't infiltrate the Islamic movement, they didn't know anything about it, but And certainly, you know, this Masui, he was up there in Minneapolis. He was the 20th hijacker, supposedly wanted to learn how to fly a 747. Didn't want to learn how to take off and land, just wanted to learn how to fly it. And the people up there said, this guy's got to be a terrorist of some sort. You know, if he knows how to fly this plane, he could fly it into a building. They reported to the FBI. The FBI wants to, locally in Minneapolis or Minnesota, want to go through his desktop computer, and the FBI in Washington, D.C. will not allow that. And they checked over with in France. They found out this man was a terrorist. He'd been part of the terrorist network. The French knew all about him, and the Americans knew all about him. But the Washington office just wouldn't let anybody go through his desktop computer. And then, of course, we're told, you know, the trouble was our FBI was just so incompetent. I mean, there was the Phoenix memo that had come in, and that was from the FBI station chief in Phoenix, who was saying there were so many of the Islamic people who were learning to fly planes that he thought maybe they were preparing for a terrorist attack. But in Washington, D.C., just couldn't connect that, couldn't connect the dots. How many times have you heard that? And they're lying. I personally interviewed the woman who ran the flight school in Norman, Oklahoma, and she told me that 11 days before 9/11, the FBI was there checking on Zacharias Masui. They knew everything about him. He was somehow or other, he was tied into a man named Nicholas Berg. You remember Nicholas Berg? He was that fellow that was captured by the radical Islamists and beheaded. He was wearing a official army jumpsuit, the most amazing thing you've ever seen. How many terrorist groups do you think have orange jumpsuits like they have at Guantanamo? We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, if you'd like to give us a call, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. One of the hardest things for people to understand is that so much of what goes on today is all manipulated. The battle between communism and capitalism was manipulated from the very beginning, and those of you who have read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, will see from the very inception of communism in 1917 and 1918, it was largely financed by American corporations and American banks, and we're getting all sorts of support from key people, figures here in the United States. Get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and read it. There's a wonderful article there by... actually, it's just excerpts from a book called Imperial Agent by our British agent, perhaps it is, by Bruce Lockhart, who was sent to Russia in 1918 by Lord Milner, who headed Cecil Rhodes Secret Society at that time. And Bruce Lockhart can't understand why he's there, and wherever it is, St. Petersburg, I guess it is, or... And Lenin is coming to him for advice, and to a man named Fred Thompson, who represents William Boyce Thompson, head of the Federal Reserve System, or member of the Federal Reserve. And he and this other American are called into all the communist meetings, and Lenin is coming to them for advice. And poor old Bruce Lockhart doesn't understand how the game is played. All he's there is just to relay information on what's going on back to Lord Milner. But, of course, if you read a lot of the literature that came out at the time of the Revolution, many people think that Lord Milner was behind the Revolution and intentionally brought it about. And then you get into, of course, consistent funding of communism since its very inception, nothing as it appears to be. Recently, in this last week or so, it's come out that the number two man of the Irish Republican Army, this vicious group of people who are blowing things up and killing people there in Northern Ireland, who is actually a British agent. The chief torturer, this is another gentleman, who tortured people and killed people for the Irish Republican Army over a period of 20 or 30 years, was a British agent. Could it possibly be that nothing is it appears to be? It's only recently come out now that the whole of the IRA from the very, very top was infiltrated by British agents. Here in the United States, we know that the mafia was thoroughly infiltrated by people working for the FBI, and when we get back, I'll tell you the story of Whitey Bulger, a man who killed 20 people and tortured many of them to death right here in the United States, I think it was in the Boston area, while he was in the employ of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the office in Washington, D.C. knew everything about it. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and there's a wonderful book. We don't carry it anymore. It's suddenly out of print, but it's called Deadly Alliance. It was written by a reporter from the Boston Globe, as I remember, who incidentally I tried to get on my program, and I think he was afraid to come on. But it was the story about the fact that the mafia in the United States was thoroughly infiltrated by our government and our government agents. And one of them was a man named Whitey Bulger, who for 20 years was an FBI informant with the mafia. During that period of time, he killed over 20 people, tortured many of them to death. The local authorities kept wanting to get him, and the FBI would always, of course, let him know ahead of time so he could escape. And eventually, of course, he did escape, thanks to being informed by his local FBI handler. And Washington, D.C. knew exactly what was going on. They sent an innocent man to prison for 30 years to cover for the crimes of Whitey Bulger. And that's a book called Deadly Alliance. You can probably get it in some of your stores. Of course, if you've read the book Double Cross, which we do have, written by the brother of the head of the mafia, he will tell you how the mafia worked consistently with the CIA. And Sam Giancano, Chuck Giancano's brother, Chuck writes the book, and we have the book. If you haven't read Deadly Alliance by Double Cross, why, we do have that one. And you get into the background of this incredible story. How could this sort of thing happen in America? The American Communist Party was thoroughly infiltrated of our intelligence agencies. It was simply a shell here. They were simply watching everything they did. The militia movement here in the United States was largely financed by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the other intelligence agencies. And this is the way the game is played all throughout the world. And yet they would try to convince you, oh, shucks, that we had no idea who any of those Muslims were. And then we find out about Abel Danger, and one of our intelligence agencies has known all about Muhammad Atta a year beforehand. In fact, when they actually had the 9/11 Commission hearings, and we have the staff report, they had pictures of Muhammad Atta taking money out of an ATM machine. I believe it was in February or March before the September attack. Where did they get those pictures? They had to be watching him. They knew where all of these people were because one of the hijackers had actually defected to the United States in April of the year 2000. You probably never heard of it, but it was brought out in the initial investigation that was known as the Joint Intelligence Committee investigation. If any of you would like to see the page from the testimony of Elder Hill on the 18th of September 2002, you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And one of the hijackers walked into the office in New Jersey, FBI office, and said, I'm trained as a hijacker. We've been in Pakistan. They trained us how to hijack your planes. I'm part of a team. We're going to hijack them, and I want to turn myself in. And you know what the FBI did? They gave him a lie detector test. They figured he was telling the truth. They gave him another lie detector test. He passed it with flying colors. And what did Washington, D.C. do? You would think the intelligent thing was to try to get the rest of the hijacking team, wouldn't you? Wouldn't that what a logical person would do? But did they do that? No. In April of 2000, a little over a year, the year and a half before the 9/11 attack, they got him out of the country as fast as they could. Why would they have done that? How did they know within 24 hours who all the hijackers were after September 11th? Nothing as it appears to be. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And our web space, RadioLiberty.com. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until we're together again, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They have to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls. We have with us this evening Alfred Adask. And Alfred's been with us before. A brilliant individual, gave a wonderful treatise on the Declaration of Independence. But tonight we're going to talk to him about his ideas on money. Now, let me point out, ladies and gentlemen, that finances, money, is the medium of exchange. If you're going to have an organized society, you have to have a medium of exchange. We could exchange rocks or sugar or salt or seashells or gold or silver, which for the many thousands of years has been accepted as the basis of money. But today we accept slips of paper with green ink on it, and we're told it has value. It really doesn't. It only has value as long as people perceive it has value. And, in fact, there is an article today in the Wall Street Journal by Robert Rubin, former Secretary of the Treasury, and it's very interesting. He's sort of warning about where America's headed. And one of the points he brings up, and I think it's a very one important point, is what happens if the people lose confidence in the currency. Well, it doesn't matter here in the United States. As long as people can buy and sell with it, it's fine. But what happens when people in other countries throughout the world really begin to value the whether our currency has anything behind it? At one time, it had gold backing, but it no longer has. The only thing behind the currency is the fact that people are willing to accept it. But what happens when they begin to lose confidence in America? What happens if we have a war in the Middle East and America were to lose that war? People say that couldn't happen, but it has happened. And, you know, there's only one worse thing than war, and that's losing a war. Well, let's get to Alfred's thoughts on what we're talking about. He wants to talk about money and finances. You pick up the story there, Alfred.
Well, let's start with, we'll get to the basics maybe a little bit later in the program, but let's start with something that's pretty fascinating. Why have we invaded Iraq? You may be aware of this already, but not many people are. Do you have an opinion?
Why do I think? I think we went into Iraq because we are moving towards World War III. We needed an excuse to get our troops in there. Certainly, you know, I've heard the stories that we had to go in there because Saddam was using, you know, was beginning to ask for euros and selling his oil for euros rather than dollars, and that's an explanation. Other people will say we went in there because we wanted to protect Israel. Others will say we went in there because certainly we wanted actually to get their oil. And there may be a little element of truth in all of those, but I really believe that this, in my own estimation, this is a prelude to World War III, and we need our troops stationed there as we're drawn into this. And the average individual doesn't understand, but the next step is going to be some sort of an attack on Iran or on Syria, but the war is going to expand, and our boys are not coming home. So, but what's your take on it?
Well, I subscribe to the notion that he started selling his oil for euros in 2000. And the reason I think that is this. Although most people, including there are publications from the Federal Reserve System that'll tell you that the value of the dollar is based, it doesn't need to be backed by gold anymore. It's simply backed by the faith and the credit of the American people. And as long as we accept dollars in trade, then it works just fine as dollars. It's a question of psychological confidence.
But what happens when the other people in other countries don't accept it as means of exchange? That's the real problem.
Well, then we're going to see some extraordinary inflation in this country, and that's where the oil kicks in. That's where the significance of the oil. Because oil has been denominated, there's only two places you can buy oil in the world, and one is at the commodities market in New York, and the other is in London. And both of them sell oil, crude oil, denominated in dollars.
And as a result, the whole world has had to have dollars if they wanted to buy oil. And because of that, there has been a constant demand for dollars from foreign countries because they had to have it if they wanted to buy oil. Now this, what I've begun to understand and some other people as well, is that this has laid the foundation for the real value of the dollar since the 1970s. It has been effectively, although perhaps indirectly, backed by oil. And when Saddam Hussein said in 2000, he said, I'm going to start selling my oil in euros rather than dollars, I believe that that was the reason we invaded Iraq. The rest of it was just so much window dressing, but we did it to protect whatever remaining value there is in the dollar. Because once the rest of the world begins to understand that they can buy oil in a currency other than dollars, they are holding mountains of dollars over there as the reserve currency in their central banks, and they're also holding it as the currency they must have to purchase oil. And once they understand that they don't absolutely have to have dollars anymore to purchase oil, they're going to say, why am I hanging on to all these extra dollars? And we've exported trillions of dollars overseas in the last 30 years. And a bunch of them are still sitting there. And if the time comes when people realize they don't need them because they could use euros, or perhaps even once they start using euros, who's to say they can't use Mexican pesos or whatever. But once we get away from that dollar, people are going to start sending those dollars back in the United States. They'll buy up the stocks in the stock market. They'll buy up natural resources. They will bid up the prices of any kind of product or natural a resource, homes, buildings, whatever in this country, and there will be an enormous amount of inflation. I believe this is the same reason why we are now threatening to invade Iran.
Well, I think it's very interesting that it's essentially what Warren Buffett has warned within the last month. You know, that they're going to soon own more of us than we own of them.
I understand.
And he actually said that they own about $3 trillion more of us than we own of them. And he said that the current rate is not going to take long before they own $15 trillion more, and that's more than the value of all of our stock market. And Warren Buffett is pointing out that there's just no way we can continue doing what we're doing. And he's very, very concerned about this. Stability of our financial system. I share his concern. So pick your story up, because perhaps you're right. Perhaps this is the reason for
it. I believe that's what's really happening here. I think that's the fundamental reason. And we started rattling the sabers at Iran last year. They had originally intended to start their new commodities exchange where they would be selling their oil for euros. It was supposed to start last spring.
It was supposed to start at the end of March of this year.
Well, it was originally spring of last year, the one it was scheduled. And we threatened, there was all of a sudden, we started talking right about the same time. We said, these people are engaged, they're terrorists, or one thing or another like that. We started threatening the war at that point in time, and they dropped the bourse. They put it off. Now the bourse is supposed to come in March of this year. And they've put it off a year, now they're supposed to, and once again, we are pushing because they are threatening that they may have a nuclear weapon in several years. And people are saying we need to invade them now. There is, in my estimation, there's a chance in four that we're going to see at least a shooting war with Iran within the next 6 months, although it may consist of not much more than Israel bombing key facilities in Iran. I've talked to some people who might know what they're talking about. You can't depend on the information, but they may know what they're talking about. They claim that there are some facilities in Iran that have been built so deeply underground that they are beyond the reach of the modern bunker busters. We can't throw a conventional bomb at them that will actually take these underground facilities out, and presumably they may have something to do with generating nuclear weapons. I have no idea. But the point, the implication from some people who might know what they're talking about, and I can't say for a fact that they do, but there is a possibility that if they decide to go after these underground facilities, the only way they're going to be able to reach them is with nuclear weapons.
Yeah, that's a rather frightening thought, isn't it?
It's a terrifying thought.
I think that something is going to happen. I don't know what it is, but you see how they're conditioning the minds of the American people, and they're coming up with all these things about how Iran is preparing to attack the United States. And who in their right mind really believes that Iran is going to attack the United States? That's like saying Saddam Hussein is going to attack the United States, or Tonga is going to attack the United States. I mean, they would be so ridiculous to even think about that, because we could wipe them right off the face of the map. But the idea that they're putting these stories out is aimed at one thing, and that is to prepare the American people for war. There is the enemy, they're the ones we're to hate, and we will be justified in attacking them. And it's only a matter of time. They're getting the people together, England, France, certainly Germany, Italy, Britain, we're talking to them over in England now, pardon me, over in Europe now, getting them to back the fact we are planning on some sort of a military exercise against Iran. Apparently we've made arrangements with Turkey for their backing. I think it's only a matter of time before something's going to happen. And I agree with you. I don't know how bad it's going to be, but I am very concerned it's going to have serious implications. And one of the things that really convinces me that something is up is the fact that Iran knows something is up, and they begin moving their money out of European banks, which is going to have an impact upon the economy of Europe, because you're talking about taking literally billions of dollars out of bank deposits, which means the banks won't have the money to lend to stimulate the economy there. So what are your thoughts?
Well, those are the real weapons of mass destruction, are the bank accounts. No one is serious. I don't believe anyone in this government is seriously concerned with the threat of some sort of an attack by Iran, Iraq, or anyone else out there right now. What they are concerned about is an attack on the money system. And I think, again, when they're pulling money out of Europe, that's going to make people mad. And when they start selling oil denominated in euros, that'll make Europeans happy, but it's going to make the Federal Reserve System in this country, as well as our own government, extremely distraught, and I suspect that will be the precipitating factor.
Well, you know, the thing is, Alfred, the things going on today just don't make any sense. I mean, we're talking about the expense of the war in Iraq, somewhere between $1 and $2 trillion. That's according to Professor Stiglitz, and he's a pretty smart guy. I mean, we're talking about, you know, everything we're doing is running a massive trade deficits and massive debts. Yeah, we have increased the debt more, you know, as much simply in a year under George Bush, as they did in 200 years between 1789 and 1989 under 1979 under Jimmy Carter. That's certainly a period of 200 years. We ran up $1 trillion in debt. George Bush is running a half a trillion dollars in debt every 6 months, every year now. And the question is, we know this cannot go on indefinitely, and I almost have a feeling they're trying to wreck our economy.
I agree with you. When you take a look, and they've taken the tariff barriers down in the name of global free trade and the New World Order, and in doing so, it's exactly as Ross Perot warned back in 1992. He warned people about NAFTA. He said, if you pass NAFTA, he said, there's going to be a giant sucking sound as all the jobs in the United States disappear overseas. And he was wrong in this regard. There was no giant sucking sound. But the jobs are clearly flowing overseas. We're losing industries. We're losing fundamental jobs. It can't be that the government did not foresee this. And the consequence will be that our standard of living is going to be diminished. The American dream is being put to an end, insofar as the American dream has been throughout most of our history, the idea that the next generation would live better than the immediate generation, that each generation we would have a higher standard of living, we would have a better life. That's gone right now.
And
it's gone because our government has allowed it to go.
And the pension funds, or the private pension funds, are going. They're going to have to make other arrangements for Social Security. They're going to have to make other arrangements for Medicare, because there's not enough money. And it's next year why the baby boomers start to retire, and within 20 years why the whole Social Security system would be bankrupt. And anybody who honestly believes there's any money in the Social Security system has to be incredibly naive. All that is there is a banknote from the federal government saying that they will redeem it, but where are they going to get the money? Why, they're going to have to get it from the American people. And they can't tax the American people anymore. They can raise our taxes. But you get to a certain point and people just quit working and quit paying taxes.
Yeah.
So the only other thing they can do is simply destroy the economy and then start in all over again and say, oh, shucks, it was at Osama bin Laden. It was responsible. If it wasn't for Osama bin Laden, this never would have happened.
Well, you know, there's some real... When you get into this, if it's true that the real reason we have invaded Iraq was to protect the dollar and to stop them from selling oil denominated in euros. If that's true, then it raises some real serious questions about what really happened on 9/11. Everyone who's seen the two airplanes fly into the two tall towers, virtually everyone is inclined to believe that the terrorists commandeered the airplane, flew them into the towers. That may absolutely be true, I don't know. But there's a third building that collapsed on 9/11. 43 stories, building number 7, part of the World Trade Center.
A block and a half away, didn't get hit by anything at all. And it came down when the
9 seconds or something like it was rough under 10 seconds, if I understand correctly.
Right, and of course the whole building, the base of the building, just exploded. And that it came down, just like the buildings you've seen in Las Vegas. And what's so interesting is they called the firemen out, and they told them the building was coming down. And, you know, they're sure enough, it just came down.
Yeah.
How did they know that building was going to come down?
Yeah.
And that, I think, is the... you could argue about the Twin Towers, and we can all have our theories, but there is no explanation for Building 7 coming down unless there are explosives planted there at the base. And, of course, you know who was in charge of security at the Twin Towers, don't you?
No, I
it was a man named
can't recall right off the
hand. His name was Marvin Bush. He happened to be the brother of the President of the United States.
Yeah.
Now, that could be just
a coincidence.
Right? Just a coincidence.
What a coincidence. Anyone who's seen the video, you know, I'd heard the stories. There have been people who've been skeptical about what happened to the Twin Towers and who flew the airplanes in. And people, some people have argued from the beginning that the two Twin Towers were wired with explosives, and that's what really brought them down. I was skeptical of that all along because I worked with explosives to some degree as a young man. I worked underground as a miner for a year and a half. And I worked with explosives, and I know a little bit about them. Not a great deal. I'm not an expert, but I know something about them. And I've also watched one of these documentaries on how they bring these buildings down with these controlled explosions. And it's not, you don't just get a case of dynamite and hide it under the stairwell. You've got to plant these explosives at virtually every beam and intersection throughout the building in order to make the building collapse like a house of cards. And it's an extraordinary, I mean, it's very difficult to achieve that without people seeing it. And to imagine that it happened in the main towers was almost incomprehensible to me. But when you see the third tower and you realize this had a steel grid, there's no way that steel grid can collapse simply in 9 seconds unless there are explosives cutting beams at every step of the way.
And, of course, that's the thing that nobody wants to talk about. In fact, I had a gentleman on the other day who was furious with me and saying I thought the Twin Towers had been taken down by explosives. Quite frankly, I don't know why the Twin Towers came down, but I do know that Building 7... if you see that, it's obvious the explosion. There is no instance in all history where a fire caused the whole bottom of a building to give way. And they don't want to talk about that.
No.
They want to talk about the Twin Towers.
The Senate did a report on what happened, and they concluded that the buildings, the two main towers, went down from the airplanes and fires caused by the airplanes. But they referenced Building 7, and they said, we don't know why it fell down.
I think that everybody, of course, there's so many things that, of course, all you have to do is remember the magic passports. There's just no way that those magic passports could have survived the flaming inferno with the names and addresses of the passports of a couple of the hijackers.
I understand.
There's no way within 24 hours they could have known who all those hijackers were. And they didn't have any idea how they were before. If they were that incompetent beforehand, how are they suddenly so incompetent to meet the afterwards? And, of course, we know there is foreknowledge for Willie Brown and so many things that you've heard us say before. So, well, anyway, let's get back to Alfred at Das, because he's going to talk about the finances, because what he's suggesting is maybe they had to have an excuse to go into Iraq to protect the American dollar. No. Well, Alfred, we got a little off the subject, so you get back on the subject here. You're suggesting that maybe they needed an excuse because they couldn't tell the American people the truth, and so we needed an excuse, another Pearl Harbor, as it were, to get us into the war.
That is the implication, and very hard to resist, and the point behind the digression where we started talking about the World Trade Center 9/11, Russell, is if that Building 3 was wired with explosives, it had to be done by people in this country. That wasn't a job by terrorists. And if it was dropped intentionally, there's a strong probability that the other two buildings, the same thing happened. And if, no matter how you parse it out between 1, 2, or 1, 2, and 7, however you want to put this together, it means that there was some sort of an extraordinary reason to make this happen. And I'm suggesting it was to protect the dollar. I'll talk a little bit about the dollar. To begin with, people are familiar that historically we had gold-backed currency. In fact, originally, all we had was gold or silver money. And if you read the Constitution Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5, it says Congress has the right to coin, the money in the country. I don't have it right here in front of me. I could pull it up, but I'm not going to read it. But the point I want to get to is they coin money. And that tells you something. A coin is a disc made out of metal. And only the Congress and the federal government has the authority to make these coins. And they don't say issue money, they say coin money, and it tells you something.
The exact term is to coin money, regulate the value thereof, add a foreign coin, and fix the standards of weights and measures. So you're absolutely right, to coin money and regulate the value thereof. In other words, but they wanted something of intrinsic value, because they knew, of course, in 1787 when they wrote that, they knew what had happened previously, the previous decade, when, of course, they printed the Continental Currency, and that's how they financed the Revolutionary War, and soon it was worthless, because there was nothing behind it. So they didn't want to make that a mistake again. That's why they wanted a currency that had solid backing behind it, so it could not be inflated and ultimately destroy the value of the savings of the population.
Well, one of the points about the use of the word coin is that it implies that money must be metal. You can't coin paper. You can't coin credit. To coin something is to take a disc of metal and compress it, stamp it with a machine, and put a little design on one face and a design on the obverse, and by that they certify that this particular disc of metal contains a certain purity of gold or silver and a particular quantity. When the government stamps that image on the front and back of the coin, the reverse and the obverse on the coin, the stamp itself isn't the money. The money is the gold. The money is the silver. The stamp is merely a certificate, essentially, much like when you have a side of beef hanging in a meat locker, an inspector may come by and stamp that beef with a series of little blue stamps that say prime, or whatever. They're telling you the quality of the beef, but the stamp is not the beef. And likewise, the image on the coin is not. That's not what makes it money. What makes it money is the metal. Now, it's possible to have things other than metal conform to money.
Hold that thought right there. Had to be gold. All right, fine. Well, our guest is Alfred Adask, and he's really talking about this concept of money, and, of course, pointing to our Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, and Point 5, that Congress was given the right to coin money and establish the value thereof. In other words, what he's saying is that money, according to our Constitution, was to have something of specific value. It was to be made of a metal. That metal was to have value. So pick up the story there, Alfred.
Part of the reason for the metal is this. The only way it was up to the people to make the money. If I wanted more money, I could make more money anytime I wanted. For example, if I get myself a burro and a pick and perhaps a pan and I head out into the wilderness. If I prospect and I am fortunate enough to find some gold, I would dig the gold out of the ground and I'd take it back to the assay office, and by before they were done, they would determine the purity and melt it down, smelt it, mix it, and they would make the coins. They would charge me a small percentage for making the coins, but when they got done, those were my coins. That was my money. I found the money. I dug it out of the ground. And one of the significant points about this is because we the people had the right to make the money by digging it out of the ground, the value of the money had to reflect the labor, the value of a common man's life. You couldn't put a different, you couldn't put a value on gold that was so absurd one way or another that it wouldn't at least pay for the man who was risking, sometimes risking his life in a mine to pull that out of the ground. We have now shifted over to credit, however, and we've shifted over to paper money, and the result is this money is issued not based on someone's sweat. It's issued on the basis of who was able to hustle themselves up into a position of political power, where by virtue of merely the stroke of a pen and their signature, they can issue hundreds of thousands, millions, billions, trillions of dollars worth of credit and or paper money.
With absolutely nothing behind it, and every time they issue more money, they devalue the money that you and I have. So the more money they create, the less the money that we have is in value. And what they're doing is destroying the value of the savings and the hard work of the American people by inflating away its value.
Well, the point that I find significant in this is you have a completely different system of values. The system of values that's behind mining gold out of the ground has to be extraordinarily tied into reality. I've worked underground, and I know that you can't go in there and hold the tunnel up with imaginary timbers. You can't be done with legal fiction. If you make mistakes, the roof will fall in and kill you. Gold ties you to a natural reality. Paper money and credit does not. The whole thing with paper money and credit can be based on legal fictions. They can be based on imaginary concepts. You are removed from reality, and it changes the whole nation's system of values. And it's a, I won't get into it any deeper, but it's something that strikes me as important. Friend of mine, back in the 90s, he had a degree in social sciences, I think, or sociology, I don't even remember, but maybe even economics, I can't recall. But he used to do an experiment. He would take a $6 bill. It was back when Clinton was in office, and many of you people saw these $6 bills. There'd be a picture of Bill Clinton on one side and maybe Monica Lewinsky on the other side, and there'd be joke comments on the bill throughout. But nevertheless, it looked kind of like a six. It looked a little bit like a dollar bill. It was a green piece of paper, and it had a six in the corners. He'd take these $6 bills into 7-Elevens. The convenience stores. And he would get himself a slushie, and he'd get himself a hot dog, and he'd go up to the clerk, and he'd hand him a $6 bill, and the clerk would take the $6 bill. And he did this several times. And the clerks would take the $6 bill, and the only problem they had was trying to figure out what drawer to put it in. When they opened the cash register, they've got those little slots for the 10s, 20s, 5s, 1s, and so on. There wasn't a slot for the six.
I hope he told them what was going on. Because
no, he never did, so far as I know. He did this half a dozen times, and the truth is he took the money from the people. But the point is, what it illustrated, is that the clerks don't know a thing about money other than the number in the upper right-hand corner. That's all they know, and it means they are colossally ignorant. And that kind of ignorance is true for most of the people in the United States. And it's a lethal kind of ignorance, and we'll explain it a little further in a moment here.
Well, I think it's so important that people understand that we have a government that is counterfeiting money. Originally, money had to have gold and silver behind it. That was the way it was when they set up the Federal Reserve System, and we were told the money was as good as gold. And then little by little, gradually, like a thief working at night when nobody was watching, they gradually stole. They stole our inheritance. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Alfred Adask, and we're just talking about these ideas of money, and everybody thinks that they understand the system. Oh, if you want to invest, you want to be in bonds, because they have, you know, you maybe only get 3%, but 3% is not so bad. The trouble is that when you're running a true inflation, not of 2%, as the government says, but probably somewhere 8 or 9%, it means that if you are invested in bonds, you get 3% interest, you are losing 5% by inflation. You're losing 8%, but they take a 3% yield, and then they have the audacity to charge you income tax on the 3%. Inflation is simply a means of stealing from the public, and they've been doing it for a long time, but now it's accelerating at a really a frightening rate. And if you begin to read what the people who are engineering this whole thing are saying, they're concerned about the stability of our currency. Go ahead.
I think we're on the verge of perhaps losing control. There is an ancient principle in money, that involving money, that goes back to at least Old Testament times, and it is that the man that owns the money owns whatever the money is used to buy. For example, suppose you were in the Old Testament, and you had a servant. If you gave your servant a couple of pieces of silver and sent him into town to buy a new burro, right? The servant might be a little bit sneaky. He might get a bill of sale that actually said it was his burro because he walked in there. But the truth of the matter was, if you could prove that the silver that he used to buy the burro was actually yours, you get the burro. Now, this principle flows from the idea that all rights, or at least it corresponds to the principle that all rights flow from title. For example, when you go to buy a car today, most people, you'll see a young man, he goes to buy a car, he can tell you about the engine and the transmission and the rear end, the wheels, and a bunch of other things on it, and he's going to buy this brand new 8-cylinder whatever. But the truth is, he doesn't buy the car, he buys the title. His right to drive the car flows from the title. The problem is, most people have no understanding of title, and they don't understand the least how it affects, how it's associated with our currency today. Most people suppose there's only one kind of title. Title is title. You got the title? You got the title of the car? Got the title of the house? Got the title to something? You got it? People say, yeah, I got the title, or no, I don't have it. Very few people understand that there are three forms of title. There's legal title, which gives you true ownership and control of a particular piece of property.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment with Alfred Adask. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Alfred was basically talking about this concepts of titles. There are various types of titles, and his thesis is it's important you understand the different types of titles. You can better understand what's happening to our currency. So pick up the story there.
Pointed out that we have three types of title. The first one is legal title. This is true ownership and control of a piece of property. But there's also an equitable title. Equitable title is the right of possession and use of a particular piece of property. And then there's perfect title, which is both equitable and legal title combined. For example, this is an illustration, it's not exactly true, but it's roughly correct. You can imagine that you might own a house. In theory, you would have the legal title. But you could rent that house or lease it to someone else. And by virtue of the lease, they'd have the equitable title. They'd have the right to use the house, to possess the house, to go in and out whenever they wanted, but they couldn't sell it. They couldn't dispose of it. They wouldn't really own it, but they would have the right to use it. The right to use it is the equitable title. But the true control is legal title. If you were living in the house and you had the legal title and the equitable title, it would be true that you would have perfect title to the home. That's what most people imagine that happens. The reason this concept of title is important
is because when you loan something, you retain legal title to whatever you loan, and the person who receives the loan only gets the equitable title. They get the right to use it, but they don't own it. Now, you may have heard the story about the Federal Reserve notes, our modern dollars, our legal tender, and how the Federal Reserve system produces these notes for a nickel apiece and then loans them into circulation for full face value. You familiar with what I'm talking about?
Right, uh-huh. Go ahead.
Okay. And a lot of people have said, oh my gosh, this is terrible, because that means the Federal Reserve's taking these little pieces of paper that cost them maybe a nickel to produce, and they're loaning them into circulation for a dollar, or $10, or $100. Cost you a nickel, and they don't have any they have no competition. How do you like to be able to put pieces of paper into circulation and get a full $100 worth of value for something that cost you a nickel, and you have no competition? A lot of people look at that and they think, oh my God, the profits these people are making is spectacular, and it's completely unconscionable. But that's not the point. The point is that because those green pieces of paper in your wallet are loaned into circulation, who do they still belong to? For example, if I take a pen out of my pocket and I loan it to you, Dr. Stan, whose pen is it?
Well, it's your pen, of course.
That's right. You get to use it. You can write with it, but it's still my pen. I am still holding legal title to the pen. Same thing with the green pieces of paper. When the Federal Reserve System loans them into circulation, the Federal Reserve System retains legal title to those green pieces of paper. You get equitable title to the green pieces of paper. And the result is that when you go out to purchase something, you don't buy it, you purchase it. If you had legal title, you could buy. But when you use those green pieces of paper, if all you've got is equitable title in those notes, and that's all you have, then that's all you can purchase with those notes. When you buy a piece of property, go buy a new computer. You get a receipt on the computer. The receipt is denominated with an S with a single line running through it. That's the symbol for legal tender. Originally, the dollar sign, the true dollar sign for gold and silver, for lawful money, is an S with two vertical lines run through it. Those two vertical lines were usually, originally it was a U over an S, meaning a U.S. dollar. Over time, they just deleted the little curve on the bottom of the U, and we wound up with two vertical lines and over an S. That's lawful money. What we've used throughout most of my lifetime is an S with a single vertical line, and that's legal tender. When you use the legal tender, I strongly suspect, I can't tell you it's God's truth, but everything leads me to believe, you only get equitable title to the property that you purchase with their money. Why? Because they still hold legal title to the dollars. Part of the evidence on this, I used to collect, I had a little business where I would take credit cards. And when I was being approved, in the process of being approved to accept credit cards, I talked to one of the representatives of the credit card firm, and they mentioned to me, just offhand, I didn't ask for the information, but it was a woman, and she mentioned to me that every credit card transaction goes through the Federal Reserve System. And I thought to myself, why do they care what I'm doing with credit card transactions? And what I've come to believe is the reason they care is they're keeping track of all of their property. It's part of the reason why the government can come in and perhaps tell you how long your grass can be on your front lawn. They can tell you things about your automobile. They can come in and perhaps the police, you can imagine a scenario where they come in, they're going to take your computer. You say, you can't take my computer, that's my computer. They say, do you have a receipt? You say, yeah, I got it right here. Show them the receipt. If the receipt is denominated with an S with a single line through it, it was paid for with legal tender.
But I think from a practical point of view, You could take the thing to court, and since most people don't understand these fine differences, I think that the courts would find that, you know, they're not going to come out and admit the whole thing is a scam.
No, they won't admit it, but nobody knows it. It
may not very well be, but from a practical point of view, I mean, if somebody comes in and steals your computer and uses this sort of an argument, I think that you could make a very, very good case in court, and you would get your computer back. And I think that certainly, theoretically, you're absolutely right, but we have a totally fraudulent economic system. And, of course, they don't even have to have the money. They can actually make it simply with a bank entry. It's not that even the money in circulation. We probably have, $600-700 billion of money in circulation. We've got trillions of dollars of money all in bank entries. That is the, here they're able to create massive amounts of money without anything even printed, really.
I understand. But the point I'm trying to get to is that if all you have is equitable title to property, then it's possible for the true owner of the property or his representative to come down and seize that property, the same as if you were leasing a home and the owner came in and he said, hey, I either want you out or you've been violating my rules relative to my property. Gold coins, the significance of the gold and the significance of lawful money is not necessary. It doesn't have to be gold, doesn't have to be silver. But it does have to carry intrinsic legal and equitable title. And when it does that, then you can use that money. You literally own the gold and silver coin. If it's in your hand, it's presumed that you own it. And you can use it to buy perfect title, both equitable and legal title, to an object, to a property. But when you've only got these green pieces of paper, I believe the only thing you're purchasing is equitable title because the notes are loaned into circulation. You don't really own the green pieces of paper in your pocket. There's a big consequence of this. The purpose of a court of law is to determine legal rights. And that's the sole purpose of a court of law, to determine legal rights. But all rights flow from title. That's a maximum of law that goes back probably several thousand years. All rights flow from title. If you don't have legal title, you don't have legal rights. If you have purchased a particular piece of property and paid for it with legal tender rather than lawful money, if you paid for it with Federal Reserve notes, with those green pieces of paper in your pocket, you don't have legal title to the property.
Well, I think that some court might very well think that that would be a suitable argument, but I suspect that an awful lot of them would not. Let's go to Ray, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Ray. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. When the dollar collapses, which I'm sure it will, wouldn't we then go into a system of bartering of some kind, and how would that work?
Well, of course, yeah. Do you have a thought on that, Alfred?
Well, you're going to go into a system of bartering. You're going to go into a system of clubbing people over the head.
Well,
I mean, it'll be when the system breaks down, it'll be a survival of the fittest kind of scenario.
Of course, Ray, the other thing is that the people we're dealing with are extremely smart. They have a plan. And what they want to do is take us into a cashless society. And I think that that's really where they want to go now, if they're able to maintain their control over the American people. If they can conceal their existence, their ultimate plan, it will be a cashless society, and you'll either buy or sell unless you wear the mark of the beast or
number
of the
beast. Yeah, that whole thing, yeah. I'm sure that's going to happen, but I don't know. My timetable for that, I don't know. I personally believe it's probably coming within about 10 years.
Okay, do you have a question for our guest?
I wanted to say that I believe that Dick Cheney is really controlling George Bush. I think he was put in there because he was defense secretary under Senior during the Gulf War. I believe that Dick Cheney was put in there to pretty much take charge, you know, over...
Well, I think somebody put him in there, and I think we're just... but, of course, this gets into a whole different discussion. Council on Foreign Relations, the Project for the New American Century, and, of course, why they would even bother to have a website for the Project for New American Century other than as a massive distraction, because all the evidence is there to show there's a cabal, and why would a secret cabal have a web page? Hey, right. Thanks so much, okay. Ray. Let's go to Ed calling from Idaho. Ed, do you have a question or comment?
Dr. Stan, I got in late, and I just started listening to the program. I'm trying to get a feel for what's being discussed, and is your guest talking basically about UCC code and whatnot?
No, I can't. I haven't been talking about the UCC code. What I'm simply... The fundamental argument I'm trying to advance is the idea that because money is loaned into circulation, that legal title to the money that's loaned into circulation remains with the party that loaned it into circulation. That's the Federal Reserve System. As a result, you only have equitable title to the money in your pocket, in your bank balance, wherever. And because of that, you can only use that money to purchase equitable title in other products. You don't actually get legal title of things you purchase with legal tender.
This sounds something along the lines that's reminiscent of UCC code.
I wouldn't be surprised if there's a similarity, but it's not something that I know about that I'm not competent to tell you about it.
Well, Alfred, what is the practical implications of this as far as everyday life? Theoretically, it's a very interesting discussion. How does it play out tomorrow morning when I go out to buy a loaf of bread?
Well, the way it plays out is you'll get that loaf of bread and you can bring it home. But let's suppose you buy a home, you buy a car, you buy something. Because you don't own legal title, you don't truly own the vehicle. You have a right to use it. You have a right to possess it. You have a right to transfer it to someone else. But you don't own it. You don't have the right of disposal. And because of that, your property that you think you own as a free man is subject to regulation on behalf of the true owner. That's the Federal Reserve System.
But, of course, it's when I go to sell the house, why I can sell it, I get Federal Reserve notes, and I go out buy something else again. And so, from a part, I mean, this is a theoretical consideration, but it does nothing confuse people because it has nothing to do with the real world.
Oh, it has a great deal to do with the real world. And here, I tried to touch on this a little earlier when I said that the purpose of a court of law is to determine legal rights. If you don't have legal title to any property that's in question, the case will not be heard at law. It will be heard in equity. And it makes for an enormous difference. You'll get the same judge in the same courtroom, but instead of hearing the case at law, he'll hear the case in equity.
Now, have you ever been into a court where they've actually, different say you can demand for a constitutional court, certainly, but, you know, the average individual, you can demand a court
of either one. That's exactly right. Here's the danger, though. At law, everyone is bound by the law, including the judge. But when you go into equity, the judge rules strictly according to his own conscience. He can listen to the law if he cares to. But he ultimately gets to rule according to his own conscience whenever he rules in equity.
Well, then, of course, you can demand a constitutional court rather than an administrative court.
If you have a legal title to property that you're arguing about.
I don't think the judge is going to make that differentiation.
I think they do. I think they do. For example, we had up until 1930s, the federal courts had two completely different sets of procedure and two completely different sets of forms to distinguish between law and equity. And based on that, if you were going to court, you could tell by the form and you could tell by the rules of procedure. You knew this case was in equity. And another case you knew for a fact was at law. But starting in the 30s, they combined the forms and they combined the procedure. In the 60s, they pretty much completed doing the same thing at the state level. And as a result, it's no longer apparent from the paperwork or from the procedure whether you are at law or in equity. And virtually everyone assumes we are going to law. And everything I've been able to see indicates we are almost always going to equity.
And so
this is the reason why we see judges issue rulings that some people say are just flat out crazy. They can do it because they're in equity. They rule according to their own alleged conscience, and that's their only real control.
No, they are under the control of the Constitution. They just refuse to abide by the Constitution.
Well, they are. Equity law form is recognized in the Constitution. It's not unconstitutional. It's simply deceptive. The people think we're going in at law. They think we're going to go to law. You're almost never at law, so far as I can see. You are almost always in equity.
And this gives the judges the discretion to rule any time they want, any way they want. And this is where we see people described it as judicial activism.
All right, John, let's go to Jack, who's calling from Michigan. Jack, did you have a question?
I want to ask Alfred if the presumed valid nature of the various commercial nexus agreements, such as the birth certificate, Social Security contract, or account number, all the way through the mortgages and various loan agreements. Is the presumption based on the fact that people are ignorantly, silently acquiescing to the fact that, oh yes, my name does appear in all capitals, and maybe my name, my body, et cetera, are in commerce through the Department of Commerce.
Let's go ahead and get the answer to that, because we're just about out of time. How would you respond to that, Alfred?
Complex question. There's wheels within wheels, but I understand what you're talking about. Strong probability, can't prove it, but the strong probability is that the all uppercase name typically identifies an entity other than yourself.
All right, does that answer your question, Jack?
Yeah, that's called the straw man.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and I want to thank you, Alfred, for being our guest, and thanks for calling in, Jack.
Thank you, Stan.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. This is Dr. Stan, and we'll be back here to sort of wrap up the program here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, this is sort of an esoteric discussion this evening, and there's some people, of course, that want to renounce their citizenship in the United States, and that way they don't have to have a driver's license, and they don't have to pay taxes, and there are all sorts of things that go along this way, and I've had many discussions with people like that, and I always like to say, you know, you're going to be the smartest person in the concentration camp, because we're dealing with people who do not abide by the law. We're dealing with people who belong to secret societies, who have an agenda, and of course most of the people involved in our government have no idea what we're talking about, but there have always been secret societies working behind the scenes that have a goal. They have an objective, and that is to create a new world order and a new world religion. How can people understand what we're talking about? Well, there's a wonderful book. It's called Fire in the Minds of Men. It's written by James H. Billington, who is the Librarian of Congress. We carry the book. We think it's an important book. And James H. Billington, the Librarian of Congress, talks about the world revolution that's going on. Not the theoretical revolution that's going on, but the very real revolution that's been going on since 1776 with a series of revolutions, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Second French Revolution, the Third French Revolution, the Italian Revolution, the German Revolution, the Russian Revolution in 1917, the Communist Revolution in Cuba in 1959. All of these are series of revolutions. But, of course, they did not have their origin in communism. Communism, of course, is simply a manifestation of the secret societies, according to James H. Billington. And all of the secret societies have their foundation in the occult. And this is really the fascinating part of the whole story, is that James H. Billington, the Librarian of Congress, writes about the Illuminati. He writes about the Carbonari. He writes about Abunerati, and he writes about the people who led the secret societies at the time of the American Revolution and the French Revolution and the Napoleonic eras, bringing them right up into, of course, the advent of communism. We are really fighting secret societies that foundation in the occult, at least according to James H. Billington. And you need to understand the background of how we got to where we are today. And when we get back here in just a moment, we'll talk to you a little bit about some of the information we've been able to put together that will give you a better idea of an understanding of how this fits together, because there truly is an occult hierarchy that rules the world. You can go up on the Internet and type in, Google in, occult hierarchy, and you will see some of my articles there. But then you'll see articles by people who are part of the occult hierarchy who describe it and the secret societies which, of course, have generated it. And we'll be right back here in just a moment to wrap up the program. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I really need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and I do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day. Trying to get people to see the world as it really is, not as it theoretically is, but as it really is. There are people who hate America, who want to bring about a one-world government. And certainly their goal is, of course, to destroy this country through illegal immigration, through destruction of our economy, through destruction of our financial system, and to transfer our jobs and our wealth to other countries, and to impoverish the American people. And they are motivated by an intense hatred of this country. They lead and work in both of our political parties. If you'd like to understand more, you can go to our website of RadioLiberty.com and pull down my newsletters on the occult hierarchy. Or if you'd like one of those newsletters free, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's the May and June 2005 newsletters on the occult hierarchy. We actually put together some pamphlets on that. If you'd like more information on the pamphlets, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's the pamphlets on the occult hierarchy. If you'd like to know what really happened on 911, why you certainly would want to get the pamphlets called Foreknowledge 911. They knew the attack was coming, and they did nothing to stop it. That, of course, is unconscionable, but then they knew the attack was coming on Pearl Harbor. They did nothing to stop it. They contrived the Gulf of Tonkin incident to justify getting us into the war. If you read my material in the syllabus, Iraq, the Untold Story, or see the video that goes with that, and I suggest the two of them together, Iraq, the Untold Story, the video, the syllabus, you'll realize, of course, that all of the wars the last century were contrived. Now, we can talk about the theoretical considerations of whether we're in equity or law, but in the practical point of view, this has no significance as far as I'm concerned, as far as the real world that we live in. The real world we live in is a world where everything that we hold dear, everything we value, is under attack today. You can get a lot more information going to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to our programs there 3 hours a day. Programs are available on iPod. They're available on MP3 files, other archive files, or live programs that you can listen to, and you can even listen to either the regular internet feed or the internet feed that comes off of our ISDN line. So the information is all there. We hope that you'll listen to our programs. You'll pull down our newsletters, and of course you'll look at the various items that we have in the way of books or videos or audio tape sets that we think are important to educate you about the fact we are involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. And there really are demonic forces. There really is another dimension. There are people who have tapped into this other dimension, and our job is to try to get people to understand the true nature of the battle we're fighting and the true nature of our enemy. So please remember again our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. And then our website, RadioLiberty.com. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and protection. Until we're together again, may the Lord be with you.